Welcome to Diversity Central, the podcast where being woke thrives. I'm your host, Dr. William White. Today, our guest is Dr. Ken Davis, a distinguished criminal justice researcher, practitioner, and a leadership scholar who performed research with several criminal justice agencies in Florida on recidivism. He serves on the board of directors for Prisoners for Christ in Jacksonville, Florida. Dr. Davis is a founding board member with the National Diversity Collaborative, where he serves as VP of Marketing and Social Media. Ken's topic today is Breaking the Cycle, an in-depth exploration of recidivism, racial disparities, and equitable solutions in the criminal justice systems. Boy, Dr. Davis, that's a mouthful. Welcome to Diversity Central.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Can you describe briefly by giving us an overview of recidivism and its significance in the criminal justice system, particularly concerning its impact on African Americans and other minorities?
Yes. I would like to start by just explaining or defining what recidivism is. It's the rate in which offenders reoffend or get reincarcerated. When people get out of prison for committing a crime, if they commit a new arrest or they violate their conditions of release, such as somebody on parole, then they're rearrested. That's how we get our recidivism rate. That person becomes a recidivist. So that's, I just wanted to clear that up first to explain what recidivism is. And that means that that person has committed a new crime in our community. Specifically, how it impacts the African-American community is because African-Americans make up a disproportionate number of people incarcerated. We have almost 2 million people in America currently incarcerated, and 55% of those individuals are African-American, despite our population only being about 12%.
Well, that's pretty alarming. Given that fact, how does recidivism disproportionately affect individuals from marginalized communities? And what are the broader societal implications?
Well, the broader society implications, first, is anytime you have a group of people that are systematically being oppressed by higher incarceration rates and by higher recidivism rates, you're taking people away from the families that can provide for their families, support those families. Specifically, a lot of men in the African-American community are not in the home, are not able to support their children and families as need be. So that's a huge impact on African-Americans, especially in a time where rising costs are factoring in issues like just housing and healthcare. So it's really important that, you know, we look at how to fix specifically communities.
Well, you know, that's a very alarming because, again, I don't think people think about the impact of having particularly a lot of minority men out of the community, because what happens is, I think that probably generates more recidivism, doesn't it?
Yes, I would agree, because you have a home without the father being present. Not that the women aren't doing a great job trying to raise those kids, but you have that breakdown of the family structure, which perpetuates the cycle of crime, poverty, and keeps the African-American community stuck in that lower class status. With all of the other barriers that's in place, add in that the child comes from a single parent home, basically, it has a great impact on the likelihood of that child being successful.
Well, you know, I think that you kind of triggered a thought in my head, because one of the things that people don't stop to realize is that it is poverty. It is those kinds of things that causes mass incarceration, because You don't see mass incarceration with people who are able to take care of their basic needs, right?
No, you don't. I think in our society, when you talk about basic needs being met, I think, we have a two-pronged discussion. You have people that are not incarcerated that are struggling to take care of their basic needs. And then when you have people that are incarcerated or returning from incarceration, and there's a lot of barriers, it becomes extremely difficult and disheartening for those people. So it makes it double difficult for them because of, systematic reasons and policies that are in place that disenfranchises the person who is a felon, a person who has served time, gaps in employment, and a person who a lot of times skills have eroded while they've sat in prison for an extended period of time. Technology has changed in advance by the time they get out. So all of those play a major factor in people being able to provide for their basic needs.
So it looks like to me, based upon what you're saying, that there must be a role that systemic factors play, such as racial disparities in policing and sentencing, play in the high rates of recidivism among African Americans and other minorities. Am I correct in saying that?
Yes, because we lack Black leadership in a lot of capacities within the criminal justice system and in places and organizations and positions of power that support and create policies around the criminal justice system, we don't have the representation or the advocacy to help make these changes within the system that and people that are looking at, ways to better the outcomes for African Americans specifically or minorities. They don't have people that, that they can relate to. And an example is the way they deal with the war on drugs with the crack cocaine epidemic versus the way we deal with, the opioid epidemic and the way now they're looking at it as mental health and treatment, whereas crack was just lock everybody up. If they die, they die, let them die. So the treatment is completely different. And a lot of it's driven because law enforcement is not a minority heavy occupation. The state attorney, which only 1% is African American across the country, they make the decision whether to prosecute and what to charge a person with. And then you get to the judges that make the sentencing, and blacks are generally given a higher sentence, even if they have a similar background in the same crime, they're disproportionately sentenced at a higher rate for longer sentencing. And these are all facts that are not even in dispute. So these are not things that, I'm sitting here making up or anybody has ever disputed. These are all facts that are consistent over time. No natural with natural ebbs and flows, it's still been consistent. That blacks are, sentenced to longer time in prison for the same crimes.
Is there a big disparity between, or is it about the same for Latinos and Native Americans?
I think, generally speaking, Native Americans, they have a whole nother specific set of issues, specifically dealing with Native American. American communities. A lot of those studies have been internal. A lot of those studies haven't been made mainstream because a lot of it has been reported and a lot of crimes are not reported out specifically on those reservations. And the laws and the rules on the reservations are a lot different from the laws and the rules and the way they prosecute crimes outside of the reservations. So, to be honest with you, the data for Native Americans can be very skewed. And that was something that probably needs to be looked at. Hispanics have similar stats to African Americans.
Right.
But Native Americans is something that really needs to be studied, but it's a little bit more complex because of the nature of those reservations and communities.
So if you were to summarize the specific challenges that faced African Americans and Latinos in particular, what would be three or four things that you would list if you were to summarize
Some of the
that may
things,
increase the likelihood of recidivism?
oh, it increased
Yes.
lack of employment opportunities.
Okay.
Those employment opportunities that are not provided a lot of times drive people back to crime. If people are not being able to make a living wage, then they try to make the money the best way they know how. So employment or lack of employment is one of the major factors. Another major factor besides employment is, I think, location and housing. The urban communities in themselves, they're highly targeted population centers. Law enforcement are hyper vigilant, and they make a lot of arrests in inner cities and urban areas. Whereas in rural areas, it's not policed as heavily. So that's going to drive crime rates and arrest rates up for minorities. So in technology, and it's still I'm still on the second one, but technology that law enforcement uses now, they're able to basically, pull your in neighbor in urban areas. You're riding in the car, the computer now, cameras can say that there's a convicted felon in the car. That's something that's new. So now law enforcement pulls over that car, and basically does searches or looks for things, or it may just cause altercations. So it's much more likely that they're going to engage when they're in certain community. They're going to have that engagement with law enforcement, which can lead to higher rates of real risk. And the final thing is, I think lack of programming to programming and mental health treatment to deal with the trauma and to deal with the challenges that they face, right? Because even when you let someone out of prison, even if you give them a job, they still have went through this traumatic process. It's probably situations where they face some trauma in prison. And you have the barriers that they're facing outside of prison. So programs that can help, mentoring groups, support groups, mental health treatment to deal with some of the ongoing issues that they may have, all could be, drivers of high recidivism rates.
Dr. Davis, I live in a currently I live in a smaller community, and we see these programs that have sprouted up all over the community, and most of them are non-minority. Most of them are white. Are these correctional programs and rehabilitation initiatives offered, or are they available to the minorities?
Because the justice system is a non-monolithic system, every state, city, and county is different. It just depends on your location. They may have some programs in the city of Atlanta, and it may be geared towards minorities, right? They may have some locations in Miami, and it may be geared towards minorities. But across the country, in general, they are not. They are not. And also, too, we have an issue with African Americans trusting in these programs.
Oh, yes.
African Americans have a historic distrust for law enforcement, government officials, because of past traumas. So you have to have buy-in from the individuals. Plus, you have to understand that there hasn't been consistent funding for programs to help people in all communities. So the programs that you see popping up, those programs are generally open to different people, but sometimes those programs, you have to be sentenced to them through the court. They're not programs where you can just check yourself into, because the funding mechanism, it was drives those programs. Who's paying for it? If it's something that's funded by a nonprofit. That nonprofit determined the mission and who they let in. If it's driven by the courts, taxpayer funding, then it that drives the courts, drives who they put in, the judges, how they sentence people. So it varies greatly, but specifically, there's not a lot of programs geared just towards minorities or African Americans.
You know that you mentioned that there are a lot of different programs out there, and because of the way we do policing in the United States, each community can be different. And the programs can be different as well. So Dr. Davis, what can we do to kind of create some place where everybody can go, and or some kind of central depository for programs where people can access them and do better and you know with this process?
It's been attempted, just to give you some background, it's been attempted before.
Okay.
It's been attempted through what they call the Second Chance Act.
Right.
George W. Bush actually signed it into law, and they had funded it with several billions of dollars. And a lot of nonprofits popped up with reentry programs across the country. That's a similar model that we could use, where federal dollars are used, funded directly to communities, but the fundings have to be consistent, and the funding has to be directed to nonprofits that we can hold account.
You know, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, when we did it the first time, you basically had a big local agency like the sheriff's office or the Department of Corrections get a huge chunk of money, and then they basically subcontract services out to different nonprofits or funded different nonprofits, similar to the way the United Way operates. They get an umbrella of money, and then they support smaller nonprofits.
Mm-hmm.
But in this realm, because these are long-term issues, a lot of those nonprofits were not, you know, able to sustain for long-term. So good work was being done. But when the funding dried up, you know, the nonprofits had to, you know, a lot of them closed and went away. So that's one approach that we could take, a similar approach, but long-term funding for these different programs. Because there's people in the community that are willing to do the work, but it takes a great deal of effort on the federal and state level to make sure that they're funded. And I think a lot of it can be accomplished through reallocation of some of the funding in law enforcement and criminal justice. Is how we spend the money is really important.
Have you are there any programs that you can think of that have that tends to be successful that are tailored specifically to challenge what minorities are facing?
No, I can't think of any that are specific to just minorities.
Okay.
Again, a lot of these programs are just specific to offenders.
Right.
Especially
right.
in this day and age, unfortunately, of people that are against, you know, diversity initiative programs, equity inclusion programs. Even before then, we had a hard time getting funding. Also, you run into the issue because people don't want to fund offender programs because they think that it's a negative. We're paying money for criminals. Why are we giving out taxpayer money, lock them up and throw away the key?
Is it the people that are that don't want it or the legislators?
Yes. Well, they don't. It's not a funding priority for them.
Right.
They'll go
that's
take
what
pictures.
I see, too.
Yeah, right. They'll go take pictures and different things, but ultimately it's not a funding priority. You know, a lot of times how they basically, when it's a photo op, they'll show up. Or when a nonprofit is doing a great job, they'll show up. But are they getting the tax dollars for it? Are they basically trying to help fund it? You know, communities, leaders, what are they doing to help fund some of these programs? Because it's a societal problem.
Absolutely.
And my approach was the federal level and federal funding could provide some type of consistency that each state establish some type of commission, I think would probably be the best approach. Because if you leave it up to different states, it's always going to be underfunded, just like a public defender system is underfunded,
Right.
it's
Much
not a
like our
problem.
education system, we have the Department of Education, and what they try to do, I mean, and they do a okay job of it, is to create some kind of consistency across the United States as it relates to, academic attainment for our kids. And they're doing a good job of it. They're doing an okay job. We're not at the top like we used to be. But that's another example of how you have individuals, communities controlling what happens, but the state, because of funding, gets in. I mean, the feds, because of funding, gets involved in the overall outcome because they have a stake in this. They're stakeholders.
Yes, I think we have to look at it from a system level to try to get some changes, because we have to have some accountability. And with no accountability, these things are going to continue. We're not progressing as a group of people, as African American, financially the way we need to be. And a lot of it is systematic issues. And a lot of it is tied into that lack of, person being family being in the household. So the breakdown of the family is leading to a lot of other issues, and it's generation, it's hurting generation after generation after generation. So we have to try to find a way to move out of it. But all the time that we look at the studies in criminal justice, it's socioeconomic issues. If you're poor, you're more likely to be arrested. If you're black, you're more likely to be arrested, right? So, as black people or African Americans, if we can move out of so many of us in that lower socioeconomic, then we have a better chance of not being arrested, unfortunately. But those are type of issues that we're facing, is we're facing it on multiple fronts. You're black, you're poor, you have two strikes against you already.
Well, that kind of leads me to a related area, and that's this whole notion that we're dealing with today on mental health and substance abuse. And could you talk to us a little bit more about how we've dealt with mental health and substance abuse in the past, and how that's changing and why?
Well, to be honest, we've done a horrible job dealing with mental health and substance abuse across the country. We haven't, since in the 80s, when Ronald Reagan came in and shut down all of the mental health hospitals because they were being ran poorly, instead of fixing them and trying to or find something else that was a better option, they basically just locked people up or push them out to be homeless people. And then from a healthcare standpoint, we're just now getting to the point of recognizing that mental health is healthcare. So most of us in the African American community had so much negative stigmas about mental health, seeking mental health treatment. We had stigmas about, a person once they got labeled, with the mental health condition. So a lot of these played into people not wanting to seek treatment. Plus, the funding for mental health treatment, just recently after President Obama passed the Healthcare Reform Act, insurance company had to include it in your health insurance. Before then, it didn't have to even be included in your health insurance coverage. So those people had challenges, finding the treatment they need for mental health and substance abuse. And we still don't have enough centers for treatment. We still don't have enough centers for mental health treatment, because we don't look at it as traditional healthcare. So until we start to invest in it and understand that it's something that, shouldn't be stigmatized, we're going to continue to have some of the issues that we have with healthcare and substance abuse treatment.
You and I have talked about this before, and one of the things that issues that came up is the whole worldview that many African American or Black males have toward mental health. My father was a Marine, and but when he came back from career, he had an alcoholism problem. My mother at the time was working as a nurse in a psychiatric ward. And encouraged him to go and seek treatment. And his answer was, I'm a Marine. I'm not crazy. So, I see a lot of African American men who won't let their manlyhood or their machismo allow them to accept the whole notion that mental health is just like other health. So, what do we do in those cases, Dr. Davis?
I think it starts at an early age with education. I think a lot of these solutions have to start at a very early age, with changing the narrative, getting males to understand that it's okay not to be okay, that we're not going to stigmatize them in a society. We're not going to call them weak because, they need to talk to someone about mental health challenges that they're having. We have people in our society who have taken their own lives, who most people would, trade their life for in a split second, did not knowing that this person was suffering from mental health issues, such as star athletes and celebrities that have taken their own lives. So now you're having other people trying to come out and advocate for mental health, and say it's okay. They're doing things now, like changing the phone number that you call for suicide prevention. They're doing things like anti-bullying campaigns. And a big thing that's driving a lot of this now is the technology, right? It's starting to have an impact on people's mental health. So the technology changes. How much time people spend on the computer. So we have to make sure that we're educating people and families in general, signs to look for, how to get help. Just having this as an understanding, from a family perspective can help people push their own loved ones to get help, when in previous generations, people didn't quite understand it. They didn't want any part of it. They didn't understand it. Afraid it was going to be labeled. They was afraid it was going to be outed. It wasn't going to be secrecy about their treatment. So those all things that, we can kind of show them now that no one has to specifically know that you're getting help. Most employers have EAP programs that you can use. We've used it, my family, with lots of loved ones, where you get confidential treatment. You just call a number. And you speak with the counselors and you set up counseling sessions, and your employer don't even know. They just pay for the program. They don't know anything about who's attending, who's not attending. That was one of the things that, I wasn't necessarily concerned. I didn't want my employer knowing specifics because they was paying for the program. But the program specifically is set up where your employer doesn't know that you are attending, counseling sessions and things like that. So and a lot of times people don't know that these programs are set up where family members can attend these sessions and they don't have to work for that employer. So the reach of the programs are really wide, but we have to advocate and teach people to use these resources inside of the Black community, which a lot of times African American community, which a lot of times we don't know that we can access some of these benefits.
So it sounds like to me we need to do a better job of advocating and educating in the African American and other minority communities, because I'm a strong believer in help yourself. You don't wait for somebody else to help you, particularly in light of what we're talking about, because the way police were originally set out to catch slaves and who were property of the slave owners, and they still have that kind of mentality when they work with minorities within police and departments today, to the fact that we've got these situations where that we just don't trust folks with all the Tuskegee Institute work that was done down there to where the institute, but in Tuskegee when they did the all that experimentation on African Americans. So, you know, we're not very trusting of people from outside of our communities, particularly in the lower and lower middle class and the pauper classes that we deal with, because we've got to do something to deal with that whole situation, to get them to trust more, and at least we can, you know, kind of embed, but had also create some jobs too. So is there anybody doing anything like that to improve the work from within the organization or within the community?
You have different mental health groups across the country that play a part in trying to advocate for more mental health awareness and mental health treatment across the country. I think one of them name is the National Mental Health Association. I have to, it's another specific one. I can't think of it right now. I will have to get back with you on that, but that deals with victims of trauma. Mm-hmm. But we have a couple of programs that are out and they're basically advocating across the country, not just to African-American community, but to everybody, that mental health treatment is something that, you know, should be, you know, tied into basic health care. We're still having problems with health care. And that's another issue, because, you know, we couldn't get a uniform or universal health care passed by the Congress. And that's impacting African-American community greatly, because people don't realize that health care drives a lot of criminal activity, lack of health care. A family can basically be bankrupt by just one emergency room visit.
Sure.
One emergency room visit, family can be bankrupt. Also, you know, not being able to get the needed medications that a person has for mental health issues, not being able to talk to someone. All of those have an impact on crime. A lot of people are self-medicating because they're not able to get the treatment that they need. That's what you see a lot of time with substance abuse. You have people that are self-medicating because in the system, we call it dual diagnosed. They have mental health and substance abuse issues, but they're self-medicating on alcohol or marijuana because they don't have access to the medicines and the treatment, because even when they get the treatment, generally it's subpar treatment because of, you know, access. They're not seeing a doctor on a regular basis. So a lot of times they're just going to self-medicate. So which can lead to arrest and drug deals and alcoholism, DUI. So it drives a lot of the crimes that we see.
These are really troubling signs. And in light of where we are in this nation today, with all the discourse and all the fighting around diversity, these kinds of issues are being kicked to the sideline, and we can't afford to have that to happen. Is there anything happening in the courts to help this whole problem with recidivism?
Currently, the only thing that's happening is there's been a shift in how they sentence people. Some states are making changes to the bail system. Bail is a primary driver of plea bargains, meaning that if a person is in prison, I mean, is in jail waiting to go to court, they're more likely to just take a plea deal because they want to get out. So you take places like Illinois, they're doing away with bail. You get arrested, you get a court date to go to court. You don't go to jail unless you committed some type of violent crime. So this lessens the burden on the county jail, less money that they're spending in, you know, officers, less money they're going to be spending in people arrested, and less money they're going to be spending feeding and housing people in the jail. And hopefully with the money that they're freeing up, they can invest in some community programs. But this is a new approach that a lot of states are looking at, because we have people that have cases that are time served cases, meaning that they're arrested. The most time they're going to get for this petty charge is 30 days, but it takes them 6 months to go to court. So they wait 6 months to go to court when they were only going to get 30 days from the beginning. So when they do go to court, the judge just gives them time served and let them out. So basically, we pay as taxpayers 5 months of housing someone, feeding someone, and this person was unable to work, provide for their families, for just basically they couldn't bail out. And, you know, the time that they could have just pled out to, or just said, I was guilty, let me get my 30 days. They didn't even get a chance to do that to 6 months. So those time served cases, that's why they're trying to reverse the bail system, so those people don't spend as much time in jail, freeing up the system and freeing up the money, because the resources is what's going to change where we spend our money. Because a lot of, and this is, it could change, but generally speaking, taxpayers don't want to raise referendums for these programs. So the money is going to have to come from private donors, and it's going to have to come from reallocation of how we spend the current dollars that we get.
Well, you know, I'm a big proponent of private-public partnerships, because I think that's the way we should be doing things in the United States anyway, because I have an issue with the government paying for everything. You know, we stop and we laugh and joke sometimes about how, you know, you and I are paying taxes and the government pays for our education, and then these businesses get us and they make millions for free. So it's it gets to be kind of crazy when you start looking at it that way. But I want to get back to this whole thing about the criminal justice, the courts. Do you see that they're focusing more on requiring people that they incarcerate to have mental health or substance abuse treatment? Are you seeing an increase in that?
Yes, I've seen that across the country. They're popping up more what they call specialized courts. The biggest and most popular one is drug court, and it deals with people with substance abuse and some mental health issues. But now we're seeing expansion where places, bigger cities like Orlando, Los Angeles, they're having what they call mental health courts. Mm-hmm. And these courts deal specifically for people with documented mental health issues. We're also having courts pop up called veteran courts that deal with military, ex-military members who've got in trouble with the law. And now generally they're suffering from, you know, mental health or substance abuse issues. So these specialized courts divert people away from the main court system so they can get the treatment they deserve where the resources are specifically dedicated. Let me give you an example. Jacksonville is one of the fastest growing cities in America.
Yes.
Jacksonville has about, I think now Metro, they call it Metro Jacksonville, has close to 1 million people. It's almost doubled in size over the past 15 years.
That's amazing, yes.
But for drug court has slot for 20 people. So they can have 20 people in drug court at one time. So those are the challenges that we're facing. They have a veteran court. The veteran court has slots for 15 people at a time.
Wow.
So you have a population of 1 million people, but drug court population is 20. 15. And military veterans court is 15. So that gives you an idea of the lack of space available, the lack of, you know, funding that these programs are receiving. I think they need to be expanded. so we can actually, you know, divert more people out of the system, right? And I think it needs to be specifically targeted for minorities. Hey, how are we going to help these minorities? We have to look at why minorities are being arrested. We have to look at ways we can help them and, you know, try to drive those numbers down, because the safer that everyone is, the safer that they are, the less likely they commit crimes, the safer everyone is.
Well, you know, I'm going to move on to something else because we're running out of time. But okay. What I want to talk a little bit about reentry challenges.
Okay.
Excuse me. And opportunities. Number one, are there specific policies or practices that disproportionately hinder successful reentry for minority populations? And if so, how can they be addressed?
I think the specific policies depends on the state, but a lot of times they have employment and licensure policies. States like New York have, where like you're a felon, you can't get your barber license, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a good trade that people can go into specifically. They learn the skill, they can use it in the urban community, become
sure.
self-employed. Certain licenses and certain employment opportunities, like certain cities won't hire people. In my city, won't hire you if you're a felon to work for the trash company, mm-hmm. right? You can't work dumping the trash if you got a felon. Things like that, policies like that, that keep people from successfully re-entering society and voting. Policies that restrict people from voting.
Mm-hmm.
If you restrict people from voting, they feel like they're not re-engaged, they're not fully back integrated into society because they don't have a voice. So I think those are some of the things that, you know, we can look at changing to remove those barriers.
You know, I know this is going to be a pretty broad question that I have to have in mind now, but I want you to just take a stab at it in any way that you want to. How can the reentry process be improved to better support minority individuals to reduce the recidivism? What can we do?
Well, I think first is to identify that, you know, minorities may have specific needs. I think identifying that minorities' needs may be different from non-minorities, and looking at programs that can address those specific needs, housing, education, employment, sustainable employment, not just survival employment, parenting classes, programs specifically dealing with mental health challenges. I think all of these are things, but I think you have to start by identifying the group that you're helping and looking at those specific needs of those individuals. And I think we have to make sure that we're advocating for these people and not stigmatizing them when they come home. We have to avoid the stigmatizing these individuals and labeling them and excluding them from the democratic process. So those are some of the things that we could do, is advocate on their behalf. They have programs called Hire a Felon. They have programs in Florida called Ban the Box, where certain cities don't ask you initially if you're convicted of felon or not, because just putting that on the application deters people from applying for the job. So they want to basically not ask the person if they're a felon until they get to the second phase of an interview, because now that gives that felon a better chance of getting the job. Because it could be a job that, you know, you can get with a felony, but generally, if you put that on the first application, it deters that person from applying, and it helps them eliminate the felon from even applying for the job. I mean, from going to the second phase. So they don't find out you're a felon to the second phase and they got a chance to interview you. That's something that can help. So mm-hmm. I think all of these are specific things that you could do to try to help African-Americans specifically, is looking at their specific needs and trying to help them.
You know, everything today is kind of centered around technology. Are there innovative approaches or technologies that could you consider unique that would help all populations? and have some emphasis on reducing the repeat offenses for minorities?
I think embracing technology at an early age and training of individuals to use technology is something that will help everyone, but specifically minority communities. And a lot of people that don't embrace it, they don't have the necessarily tools to, you know, have gainful employment. A lot of jobs now, you can't walk in and fill out an application. There's no paper application. You have to go online to apply to the Burger King, the McDonald's. Just basic jobs now, there's no paper application. Some employees used to have computers in the business where you can sit there and apply, but those are disappearing. So you have to have access to technology. You have to understand how to use it. I know one program here in Jacksonville in Orlando called Operation New Hope. They have computer training for ex-offenders. When they get out, they think 6 weeks of basic computer training. So they learn how to use a computer. And some of them actually go on and, you know, decide to further their education and go back to school once they get a understanding of how to use a computer, because now that computer allows them to take classes online so they can still work. Whereas, you know, trying to navigate going to work and going to school could be a barrier. So now just being comfortable with the computer can help that person do both. So I think, you know, making sure that offenders have access to technology and that they understand how to use it is critical.
As you know, I'm a I'm a recovering chemist. And so data is very important to me. What role can data and analytics play in identifying patterns and implementing effective interventions that address racial disparities in recidivism?
Well, I think we're starting to see some of it currently, because previously data was basically published at a very slow pace. So you couldn't see crime rates until 2 years after they happened. Mm-hmm. Now, when a person goes to court in most counties, you can see what happened in that case the same day. So having access to real-time data, you can basically track trends better. And with software and data analytical software, you can look at trends and pinpoint a judge that's sentencing minorities to more time than he's sentencing non-minority offenders to in real time. Mm-hmm. And they rate judges. They have these applications now, and they rate the judge. Is it an A-rated judge, B-rated judge? So technology is giving us the ability to see data at a much quicker pace and to be able to analyze it and make draw conclusions from it and make recommendations of change very quickly.
Well, when we see this these data, and they show us information, are we able to react to it and make changes, or does this just kind of fall in some kind of political hole?
I think at this point, I think it's kind of the latter, mm-hmm. because I think we've had a movement in the country where education is being downgraded, right? Being smart is not a, you know, popular thing. We've had people to, you know, come out and say, you know, things that are not true, and people believe it. So experts are basically being questioned, and they're taking the word of people who are not experts in the field, who have no facts to back it up. So I think, you know, and they're calling it fake news and, you know, just laughing at the stats and the data. But I think, to be honest with ourselves, we have the tools and the capability, but we have to embrace it. And we have to be, you know, leaders and make that change to say, okay, this is not working. We have the data to back it up. We can prove what's happening. One of the things I brought up earlier was Blacks are historically sentenced at a higher rate than whites for the exact same crimes, even though they have the same background, right? It's almost like the study they do study after study that whites basically and blacks with the same credit score get different approval rates. Study after study, year after year, the data doesn't change, but nobody's held accountable for it. No action is taken. So we got to move from just talking about the data to using that data to hold people accountable.
Absolutely, because you know, data is nothing unless you use it. And data has to be complete. And I say that, and this is not the forum for a discussion on banning books, etc. But what you did bring up was this whole notion of critical thinking. And as an educator, you and I both know that in order to be a critical thinker, you must have all the information. And if you don't have all the information, then you're going to be flawed. And as a child, I was always told by my parents, and also growing up in a segregated neighborhood, well, it wasn't a segregated neighborhood, but segregated school system, I was always told that, you know, you have to make sure that you understand what's going on. Otherwise, you're going to repeat it all over again. Every 25 years, they would tell us that you're going to do the same old things over and over again. So again, you bring up some important factor that I think people need to realize. You know, banning books is just not something that's bad. It's something that's very dangerous, because information and discourse is at the center of our education system. Let me back off, because that's a very, very tender subject for me, and I think that it's something that we got to get our arms around. How do you measure? Any comment on what I just said?
No comments. I agree with you, but no comments.
Well, how do we measure the success of programs aimed at reducing recidivism? How do we measure them? Again, I'm still kind of on my data geek thing.
Well, the success is you measure it both by quantitative, you know, success. They track the offender success in the program for 5 years, whether they get rearrested or not. Mm-hmm. So there's quantitative data that can be used to see how successful the program is, but also you do it by qualitative data.
Mm-hmm.
How does it impact, you know, the family, the community, right? Stories that are being told, how does it change someone's life? But one of the things I always like to point out to people, and I'm gonna be very quick with this, is we don't shut down the hospital because a doctor committed malpractice and somebody died, right? But in criminal justice, the public, if we basically have a person out and this person go out and there's in the program and that person goes off and kills somebody, then now everybody want to shut that program down and say, see, these programs don't work, right?
Mm-hmm.
That was one person, right, that did something bad.
Right,
we can't
right.
hold everybody accountable or shut down the programs because somebody, there's always going to be somebody that is not going to, you know, gain from the program. There's always going to be bad apples, right? So we can't shut the program down because of that. Like we wouldn't shut down a hospital because one doctor committed malpractice. We still need hospitals because we still have sick people. So we still need these reentry programs because we still have people coming out of prison that need help transitioning back into society.
You know, Dr. Davis, we have a horrendous number of people incarcerated on simple drug charges. President Biden recently issued an order that said that these folks are to be released. Are we prepared to deal with them? Because a lot of them are you know, three strikes you're out drug felonies, and it was very minor offenses, and they're still caught up in this whole process of recidivism. So how are we going to handle the millions of people that are in jail, or not the millions, but the hundreds of thousands of people that are in jail for simple drug charges that are caught up in this loop of recidivism?
Well, I got a very unpopular answer with that. A very, very unpopular answer. I think a lot of the drug situation with the drug charges, I think legalization in a lot of areas would solve a lot of those problems. Because I think as a society, we have to move past incarcerating people for simple drug possession charges. A person that's using drugs, we find them, they have a personal amount of drugs on them. They've been caught five times, and then we send them to prison for 10 years. We pay $50,000 a year to keep them in prison because they had a $50 bag of cocaine on them. I think we have to move past that. I think we have to look at ways that we can, criminalize crimes that are making it our society more dangerous and focus on those crimes and stop criminalizing, petty drug cases. We can still hold people accountable,
Yes.
but the idea of incarcerating them for long periods of time
Well,
for
we have some
a
lifers, as you know,
yes, when
on
you
minor
have other
drug possession.
programs that take some of that same money and use it in treatment programs or residential programs or something where it can be more productive, as opposed to, like I said, $50,000 a year to lock somebody up for a $50 bag of cocaine that only person that was hurting was themselves.
Dr. Davis, one of the things that reminds me of when I was living in Los Angeles, it was not uncommon to see somebody who was arrested twice for a minor drug marijuana possession. And then the third time, this woman, she went out and she stole milk for her kids. And that was a three strikes. And she was going to jail forever. And this kind of craziness, as you said, at $50,000 a pop, and what they're doing to families and communities is we have to do something. So I'm always looking at trying to find out what are some of the things that we can do to reduce the recidivism problem and get more people involved in working in their communities and building up their communities.
Well, the model is already out there in some places. They're working on it now, and the data should be out in a couple of 5 to 10 years, like Portland. Drugs, they decriminalized drugs up there. Cocaine, heroin, marijuana, all of it is non-criminal. You get a citation. And we're gonna see how that impacts their incarceration rates in their jail, but we're also going to see how it impacts the health in their community. Because I'm not saying people can't be punished or shouldn't be punished, but I think that incarceration, just simply locking them up for a long period of time, is not the answer.
Is there anything else as we get to the end of our discussion? What are some of the things that you'd like? How would you summarize this? What would you like to leave in the minds of our listeners?
I would like to leave that, recidivism impacts everyone. It impacts your bottom line as far as your taxes. It impacts your funding for schools. It impacts your safety in your neighborhood. It impacts the likelihood of your child being successful in life, right? It basically impacts everything around you. So I think everyone has to understand that understanding these issues and welcoming people back into the community is not something that should be taken lightly, but I think it's something that we all should embrace, and we should advocate for programs in our community that does this work and help support those organizations through donations, volunteering, and advocacy efforts.
Great. This has been a very informative discussion that everyone interested in fairness and safety within their community should listen to. Breaking the cycle, an in-depth exploration of recidivism, racial disparities, and equitable solution in the criminal justice system is just one examination that highlights the urgency that we should have to deal with this problem. This exploration underscores the need for equitable solutions to break the cycle. And that's critical to break the cycle, promoting a more just and inclusive society where every individual has the opportunity for rehabilitation and reintegration, regardless of their background or circumstances. It impacts everyone, as Dr. Davis has said, and everyone should be involved. Thank you again, Dr. Davis, and thanks to
Thank
all
you.
Our listeners. Excuse me, you're welcome. And thanks to all of our listeners. You may reach Dr. Davis at kdavis@nationaldiversitycollaborative.org. Join us again next time as we continue to explore the different challenges created in our diverse society. Until then, celebrate the diversity around you and make a difference.